This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Riz Ahmed stars in the new movie Sound of Metal. He plays Reuben Stone, a punk metal drummer who goes deaf. Riz Ahmed won an Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Limited Series or Movie for his performance in the HBO series The Night Of, making him the first South Asian man and the first Muslim to win in that category. He's also been in Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, Jason Bourne, Nightcrawler, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, Four Lions, and The Road to Guantanamo. Riz Ahmed is also a rapper. He released an album this year called The Long Goodbye. He started rapping as a teenager on pirate radio stations in London. In Oxford, where he graduated from, he competed in rap battle competitions and recorded a track called Post 9/11 Blues, which became popular on the internet. Riz Ahmed's parents emigrated to England from Pakistan in the 70s. Let's start with a clip from Sound of Metal, which is streaming on Amazon Prime. Ahmed's character Reuben is a drummer who's half of a duo with his girlfriend Lou, who plays guitar and sings. They're only two people, but their music is very loud. They're living in an RV, on the road, on tour, playing one-night gigs, when Reuben starts to lose his hearing. It quickly progresses until he can't hear anything except for noise and distortion. The doctor tells him he could regain some of his hearing with cochlear implants, but that would cost about $40,000, which Reuben doesn't have. Reuben is a recovering heroin addict, and music is his life. Without it, he has no idea who he is or what his life is about. And without music, he's more vulnerable to relapsing. He's referred to a deaf community for recovering addicts to get some support. With his girlfriend Lou, he meets with Joe, who runs the facility. Joe is deaf and is a recovering alcoholic. Joe can read Reuben's lips and has voice recognition software that translates what Joe is saying into words on a screen that Reuben can read. Joe is played by Paul Rassi, who speaks first.
Well, I think it's important that you stay here with us right now, Reuben. Learn some sign language, find some solid ground. What do you think?
Man, it sounds great, but we don't have a lot of money right now.
Well, sometimes our church sponsors deaf people in need, and right now, you fit the bill, Reuben.
We're really not church-going people.
Sorry, Reuben, I read lips. I can't. What'd you say?
We're not religious, either of us. Very much not into religion. No offense. You know.
Religion plays no part in this, Reuben. The church helps people in need, not religious people. The important thing is that you want to stay here.
Mm. Yeah.
Lou, do you think Reuben needs help right now? You understand, if Reuben were to stay here, he'd have to do it on his own. Members live in a house separate from the outside world. No contact to the outside world. No phones. I found that in all cases, that's the way it works best.
Yo, hold up a minute, okay? Let me catch up. Okay?
Can you help Reuben commit to that, Lou?
You want to try this for a couple days? We have our own home. We can stay in the RV.
Oh, I'm sorry to say that's not the way that works here, Reuben.
Well, that's a problem, then.
Do you have anywhere you can be during this time, Lou?
Yo, that's that, man. We're done. Thanks a lot for your time, bro. Appreciate it. Okay? We're out, baby. Let's go.
Riz Ahmed, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
After playing someone who's lost his hearing and who hears only noise and distortion, are you noticing sound and sounds in ways that you never did before?
I learned American Sign Language for the role over 7 months, and my sign instructor, Jeremy Stone, who's also a deaf advocate and a kind of leading light in the New York deaf community, really kind of welcomed me into his peer group and immersed me in deaf culture. And I realized that listening isn't something you just do with your ears. It's something you do with your whole body. You know, it's very much about being present, being sensitive, being open physically to the energy someone else is putting out there. And I guess through American Sign Language, I kind of felt like I was communicating more deeply and in a more connected way than I ever could have with words, because when you're communicating with sign language, you're communicating really viscerally with your whole body. And so as much as the experience of deaf culture taught me to value my auditory hearing, I feel like deaf culture a world without hearing and without, you know, sometimes verbal communication actually really taught me the true meaning of communication and listening.
I don't know American Sign Language, but it's always been a marvel to me that there can be enough hand signals and body gestures that can cover all of the language. What did you learn about some of the subtleties of sign language?
You know, in some ways, I kind of feel that sign language allowed me to communicate more fully than words did. You know, I touched on that a moment ago, but another thing that Jeremy Stone taught me was, as you can tell, he's had a big impact on the project, and I actually named the character Ruben after him and named him Ruben Stone. One of the things he said is that, well, there's this trope in the deaf community that hearing people are emotionally repressed. And the reason for that is that they hide behind words. And I kind of like, you know, just took that on the chin and kept going. But it was later when I became more fluent in ASL that I understood what he was talking about. And when I first started communicating, you know, Jeremy and I became very close. We'd be meeting every day, speaking for several hours and signing. When I started talking about things in my life or even in Ruben's life that were emotional, I found myself really physically getting emotional, you know, tearing up at times in a way that I would not have if I was just verbally communicating. And as I said, that's because you are inhabiting physically what you are communicating in a completely different way. You're not hiding behind words, as we sometimes can in the hearing community.
Your early roles were very much defined by the characters you were playing being Pakistani or Muslim, or in some cases terrorists or would-be terrorists or people mistaken as terrorists. So did it take a while before you were playing roles that weren't defined like that?
Well, I think it's something that's happened in parallel. You know, there's been those roles earlier on in my career, like, for example, The Road to Guantanamo. But in amongst that, you always had films like Shifty, for example, where, you know, I'm playing a lead role in a film where it wasn't about the post 9/11 circus in some way. Now, I should say that I kind of made a commitment to myself at the very start of my career that I actually wouldn't be playing two-dimensional terrorist roles. I didn't want to help reinforce some of the negative stereotypes about people like me or people like my family. You know, when I joined this industry, in many ways, I think what motivated me to join this industry and what inspires me about the power of storytelling is the ability to subvert and overturn these unhelpful narratives that we have about marginalized groups. But more broadly, I guess that's the power that stories have to rearrange people's mental furniture, to just blow their minds, quite literally, until they realize that those categories of us and them that they use to view the world actually don't apply. There is no us and them. There's just us.
So your first movie role in 2005 was The Road to Guantanamo. And this is based on the true story of three British citizens of Pakistani descent who traveled to Afghanistan in 2001 and are mistakenly detained as terrorists and sent to Guantanamo. And these three young men became known as the Tipton Three. So you were traveling with the movie to the Berlin Film Festival, where it won a big award. And on your way back, you were stopped at the airport. And I want you to tell the story of what happened to you when you were stopped and questioned.
This film went to the Berlin Film Festival. We won the Silver Bear Award. We were coming back triumphant, you know, pinching ourselves, this tiny low-budget movie against the odds that won this prize. And after we'd gone through passport control, actually, when we were at baggage claim, someone kind of breathlessly ran up to us and actually a group of what later emerged to be British intelligence officers kind of rounded us up, really, and said, you know, asked us to follow them, took us into unmarked rooms, and basically engaged in what later turned out to be a completely illegal kind of harassment. They purported to be holding us under these anti-terrorism laws. They must have thought we couldn't read because the piece of papers they handed to us, just none of those conditions applied to what was going on. And they basically just started saying, you know, did you become an actor to further the Muslim struggle? You know, what do you think of the Iraq war? It was really quite, you know, worrying state of affairs, I guess, in a democracy when you have people being harassed for artistic expression. You know, I mean, this isn't like fringe stuff that we're throwing up on the dark web. This is just one, a major prize at European Film Festival. It's been on Channel 4, national broadcaster. It's a publicly financed movie with Film 4, you know, backing the movie. And I guess, you know, it's something that kind of shook me up. It really frustrated me. But, you know, in the wake of that incident, I guess I just realized a couple of things. One of them was that, well, I was offered to kind of, you know, go on the news and hold a press conference. It was about what happened because it was so patently illegal. I was offered to kind of sue the government. And I kind of just felt like I actually wanted to put it into my art. I wanted to, didn't want the first time I was on TV to be as a victim around this, but I did also feel a responsibility. And so it was an experience that kind of like shaped a lot of my work after that. And that's what led me to write the post 9/11 blues, you know, that kind of viral rap song that you mentioned at the start, which is a satire, which got banned from radio, which they even, you know, just kind of made me want to double down on it.
So we were talking about how your kind of breakthrough recording, post 9/11 blues, was recorded the same year as your first movie, The Road to Guantanamo. And this is a satirical song. It's kind of lighthearted in spite of what it's talking about. It reminds me of some like satirical, lighthearted early rap records. So let's hear Post 9/11 Blues. This is Riz Ahmed.
What can I do? I got the post 9/11 blues on the telly, nothing but the post 9/11 news. War, Iraq, suicide bombs. Stop hogging the limelight and make some room for my songs. Anyway, it's all reruns. We need a new war. Bush, go get Iran. I heard they're talking about your mom. Change the channel, watch some telly for kids. But what's this?
Hi kids, welcome to Fun Fun Fundamentalist.
In the breaks, Nike's advertising bomb-proof kicks. They're even showing Bin Laden's cave on Cribs. So I picked up a respectable magazine. Told me about the new post 9/11 categories. Israeli fighters are soldiers, Irish are paramilitary, and darky ones are terrorists. How simple can it be? But not me, my friends go, Riz is still one of us. But if I haven't shaved, they won't sit with me on the bus. Everybody do the post 9/11 dance.
That was Riz Ahmed and his recording Post 9/11 Blues that was recorded in 2006. And that became big on the internet. It went viral. How did it go viral? Do you know? Like, it was before Twitter, right?
Yeah, this was back in the days of MySpace. I think people just started sharing it. I think, you know, usually when things start getting shared like that, you're managing to tap into or articulate something that is on many people's minds, but they haven't quite been able to express yet. And usually when you do that, it's not because you're trying to reach outwards and outside of yourself to tap into some external big picture zeitgeist. It's actually because you're reaching inside yourself to really look honestly at what you're feeling. Which isn't the easiest thing to do, to be honest, particularly if you have been implicitly told time and again that your story may not be relatable or universal, that your perspective may be considered niche. It actually takes a big leap of faith to dig into the specificity of your experience and talk about it and believe that it will be relatable and interesting to people.
I want to talk about your acting. I think the first time I saw you was actually in Nightcrawler. And I think this is a terrific movie. Jake Gyllenhaal plays somebody who wants to, like, you know, make money selling footage to news stations. And so he figures his ticket is to go with the kind of if it bleeds, it leads type of news shows. And so he monitors the police radio and tries to get there even before the police do, and shoot crime scenes and accidents and any place where there's likely to be blood, he'll be there with his camera. And he's also quite a manipulator and deceiver. And you play the person who becomes his assistant. So I want to play a scene in which you're basically meeting him in a diner, going on a job interview for this. And he's asking you about your job experiences, and you're very naive and very shy and not forthcoming, but you basically tell him that you don't really have any job experience, you're kind of homeless, but, you know, actually, you're going to be perfect for the Jake Gyllenhaal character because he needs somebody who he can manipulate to do whatever he wants done, which isn't necessarily going to be good or legal or honest. So after you've told him that you have no experience and you're kind of homeless, here's his question to you.
Why hire you? Sell yourself.
Yeah? Okay.
Go.
Okay. Well, I'm Rick, of course. I took 3 buses to get here. I finished high school. I need a job. I'll do pretty much anything. That's me. Hi, Rick. So.
What's your address, Richard?
I don't have one, right? Not a permanent one, I mean, right now.
You're homeless.
I was for a while.
You trick.
Work the street? No.
Wasn't a question.
I'm straight.
Plenty of straight guys trick. Do you have a driver's license?
Yeah.
Do you know Los Angeles?
Yeah, I grew up all around here.
Can you start tonight?
Doing what?
I run a successful TV news business. We film breaking stories. Maybe you saw my item this morning with fatal carjacking.
No, I mean, I don't have a TV, but that sounds cool.
Do you have a cell phone?
Yeah.
Does it have GPS?
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Congratulations, you're hired.
Okay.
Your job will be to listen to the emergency radio, learn police codes, help navigate, and watch the car.
Okay. And what does it pay?
It's an internship.
Man, I can't do that. I need money.
I'm giving you a chance to explore career options and gain insight into my organization. It's not at all unusual for me to make full-time job offers to my interns.
No, I know. I gotta get paid, like, something at least, you know?
I'll give you $30 cash per night.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Oh, your character has no idea what he's getting himself into. You know, I think I love contrasting your naive performances with your really cold performances. And so this is an example of you being like not really, you know, that bright or... and you're very naive. In another performance that I really love in the HBO series The Night Of, you play a young man who borrows his father's taxi cab without telling his father. And you're going to drive to a party with it, but you end up picking up a young woman, young attractive woman who is hailing a cab. You go home with her, you sleep with her, you do a lot of drugs with her, wake up and find that she's murdered. And we have every reason to believe that your character did not do it, although he has no memory because he did so many drugs and he doesn't really know what happened. So he's looking very guilty to people. He's put in prison, and you get so hardened in prison. By the end of this movie, like, you've become this really hardened, cold person who is almost physically unrecognizable from the person who you started as. And I'm interested in hearing what you put yourself through emotionally or physically to progress to that point.
Well, I guess with any role you take on, you try and see them as a real person. And as such, I think research forms a big part of the process, or at least it always did for me. So for Nightcrawler, you know, there isn't any backstory really given to that character, but there's that interview scene that's very telling, and it's... You know, he doesn't have a fixed address. And I remember it was my first time spending time in LA and someone told me about the homelessness problem there. And so that kind of just set me down a course of spending a lot of time volunteering and attending homeless shelters and programs down in Skid Row, which was really eye-opening. And you kind of end up piecing the character together from the clues and the interviews and the people that you pick up along that research journey. It was similar for me with The Night Of. Two groups in particular really helped me. One was South Asian Youth Action, which is a youth group in Queens, helping South Asian kids. And the other one was the Innocence Project, which overturns wrongful convictions using DNA evidence. And yeah, just a lot of research, heading to Rikers Island Prison and various different correctional facilities.
And finally, I want to ask you another question about your new movie, Sound of Metal. you know, your character in it is in this like punk metal band. The music they play is really loud and distorted. And he wakes up one morning and puts a Bessie Smith recording, a vinyl Bessie Smith recording on the turntable. And I kind of love that moment because it shows that he's interested not just in the kind of music that he's played, but he has what is probably pretty wide-ranging musical interests. And I'm wondering if that describes you too, and if people would be surprised that although you're known musically for rap, that you have tastes like way outside of that in addition to loving rap.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I realized, like, spending time in the punk scene and the metal and the noise scene in New York, is a lot of these guys are real soul heads or funk heads, you know. They just like enjoy musical virtuosos and appreciate rhythms and melodies, even if that isn't their language of their expression. I mean, for me, you know, the influences that make me up are the influences that make up London. And some of those are from America, some of those are from Europe, some of them are from the UK, and some of them are from South Asia. And so I guess what goes into my music is a mixture of that. It's that Afro-Caribbean sound system culture that has such a big impact on London life, from garage and drum and bass and grime, dubstep, US hip hop, which I've grown up on my whole life, and, you know, idolizing artists like Mos Def, but also that South Asian heritage of Qawwali music, you know, which is a mixture of singing, spoken word, and a kind of rap, really, storytelling, kind of Sufi devotional, kind of gospel-esque music. And I guess those are the three elements, you know, that I kind of blend together in my own music.
Well, Riz Ahmed, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Riz Ahmed stars in the new movie Sound of Metal, which is streaming on Amazon Prime. Our book critic, Maureen Carrigan, says that even she sometimes had trouble focusing on reading this year. But not with these books. Here's Maureen's list of 10 top books for 2020.
There's an underlying quality of solitude about this pandemic experience. Sealed into our little Zoom boxes, masked when we're in contact with others, many of us feel separated from the world by split-second time delays and a thin layer of lint. Books break through. They enter directly into our heads, occasionally our hearts. Here are 10 of the books that broke through for me during this tough year. Ruman Alam's Leave the World Behind is an extraordinary, shape-shifting novel that begins, as so many stories do, with a journey. A white family is driving out to an Airbnb in the Hamptons on Long Island for vacation. What begins as a domestic tale soon morphs into a comedy of manners about race when the black couple who owns the Airbnb unexpectedly turns up. Slowly, that comedy of manners sours into a vision of global disaster that Alam's characters and readers alike will keep denying. Sound familiar? James McBride is such a buoyant poet of a novelist that he could write a book about paper clips and I'd read it. Fortunately, his novel Deacon King Kong is about so much more. Set in a Brooklyn housing project in the 1960s and focused on the apparently random murder of a neighborhood drug dealer, the novel captures the rough-edged communal life of a vanished New York. Two vivid historical novels carried me away this year. Jess Walter, who's one of my favorite novelists, brought out The Cold Millions, about free speech demonstrations that erupted in Spokane, Washington in 1910 and 1911, pitting police against transient workers, many of whom identified as Wobblies. Walter's story is reminiscent of sweeping novels by the likes of Herman Woke and Howard Fast, tellers of big tales about the forgotten foot soldiers of the past. The Pull of the Stars by Emma Donoghue is set in a Dublin maternity ward in 1918, a city hollowed out by the Spanish flu, the First World War, and the 1916 Irish uprising. She gives us a cityscape of empty schools and cafes and the ubiquity of masks, here quaintly described as bluntly pointed like the beaks of unfamiliar birds. This is an engrossing and inadvertently topical story about healthcare workers inside small rooms fighting to preserve life. Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu, which just won the National Book Award, is also a story set in small rooms, as well as an inventive satire about racial stereotyping, particularly of Asian Americans. His main character, Willis Wu, lives in a rooming house and has a bit part in a TV cop show called Black and White. About his career in show business, Willis tells us that, first you have to work your way up, starting from the bottom. It goes, background Oriental male, dead Asian man, all the way up to the pinnacle, Kung Fu guy. Casey Peabody, the 31-year-old main character of Lily King's novel, Writers and Lovers, also aspires to something more. Casey wants to be a novelist. In this story, King captures the chronic low-level panic of taking a leap into the artsy unknown and the cost of sticking with the same dream for perhaps too long. Mysteries, as always, kept me sane-ish this year, and the best one I read was Tana French's standalone suspense tale, The Searcher. A Chicago police detective moves to the rural west of Ireland and finds that evil follows wherever he goes. The beautiful and menacing landscape of The Searcher may make you feel better about spending more time indoors. On to nonfiction. Cast by Isabel Wilkerson is deservedly one of this year's big books to ruminate over and argue about. Wilkerson's central insight, that possibility in America is largely predetermined by a racial caste system, is dramatized through what's become her signature style of argumentation, through vivid anecdotes and charged metaphors. We Keep the Dead Close is the title of Becky Cooper's meticulously researched account of the murder of a female grad student that took place at Harvard in 1969 and remained unsolved until 2 years ago. In Cooper's narrative, the sexism and elitism of academia are the culprits that still remain at large. The violent death that poet Natasha Trethewey writes about in her harrowing memoir, Memorial Drive, is that of her own mother, who was murdered by her stepfather. Trethewey was 19 at the time. Memorial Drive is about memory, race, and the phantom aches that can't be laid to rest. Of all the books I read this year, this one was emotionally the hardest and the one that felt most crucial to take in. Here's to more good books and better times in 2021.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can find all of Maureen's year-end recommendations on our website, freshair.npr.org. And to browse more than 380 titles recommended by NPR staff and critics, visit the Book Concierge at npr.org/bestbooks. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Our next guest is photographer Bob Gruen. He spent decades capturing the lives and performances of rock musicians from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. The list includes The Stones, The Who, David Bowie, Bruce Springsteen, Chuck Berry, Elvis Costello, Bo Diddley, and The Clash, just to name a few. But Gruen didn't just take pictures. He lived a rock and roll lifestyle, hanging with musicians backstage and in their studios, and traveling with them on tour, with plenty of drinking and drugs along the way. He has a new memoir which recounts some of his stories, including touring with the Sex Pistols, a tense confrontation with Bob Dylan, and a showdown with Yakuza gangsters at a hotel in Japan. Gruen's memoir is called Right Place, Right Time, The Life of a Rock and Roll Photographer. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Bob Gruen, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, well, thanks for having me.
You grew up on Long Island. Your mom was a photography buff, right? So you got interested at an early age. And I love the story of the first photo you got published. Share that with us.
You know, my mom was an attorney, but her hobby was photography. And she taught me to develop and print my own pictures when I was very little. And I started taking pictures around the house and around the neighborhood and in school. And then one day coming home from school, I saw a fireman arriving at a fire, and I ran over and I took pictures of him and ran out of film and ran home, got more film and ran back and actually climbed up in a building behind the fire onto the roof of a six-story building behind it and got almost like an aerial shot of the whole scene. Went back home, developed it right away and brought it down to the local newspaper. And they liked it, and they actually printed it on the cover. And they were impressed with me. I was 13, and actually half the caption is about how the 13-year-old Bob Gruen took this picture and, you know, was into photography. So it was a good start.
You got into rock music. I mean, you loved rock music, right? It was really exploding at the time in the late 60s. And so you started going to clubs and photographing people. And it's interesting that when you were doing this and trying to get work, one of the things that you did was to shoot not just the musicians, but the managers and the publicists, and even in the clubs, the staff, the bouncers and the bartenders. Why was that useful?
I probably gave away more pictures than I licensed, but it was useful because that way people would remember me. That if a publicist hired me to take pictures at a press party of a star with some other rock stars visiting him, I would also get a picture of the publicist with the star, and then they would put that on their office wall, and they'd remember me. And so I was always doing that to stay in people's mind and to give them something special, to get, you know, to not just take, but to give. And people would remember that.
One of the first relationships you developed with a high-profile musician was with Ike and Tina Turner. How did that happen?
Well, a friend of ours told us that Tina Turner was amazing. We had to go and see her. And we went, and my friend was right. Tina is just absolutely amazing. They were playing several shows around the New York area at the time. And so the next night they were playing in a place called the Honka Monka Room. You can't make something like that up. On Queens Boulevard in Long Island. And we went there. It was a very small club. I remember the linoleum floor and small stage. But Tina was just amazing. And I was sitting right in front taking pictures. And at the end of the show, a strobe light flashes. And Tina kind of dances off with multiple images in the strobe light. And I just had a few frames left in the camera. And I thought, I wonder what will happen if I take a one-second picture and get a few of these flashes in the same frame. And I took like four or five pictures, and three or four of them are useless, and one of them is one of the best pictures I've ever taken. And it just captures Tina in five images that just captures the excitement and energy that's Tina Turner. And we went to another Tina show a couple of days later, and I brought the pictures basically to show my friends. But as we were walking out, one of my friends saw Ike Turner walking from one dressing room to another and pushed me in front of Ike and said, "Show Ike the pictures." And he stopped and he said, "What pictures?" And I showed him. He said, "Oh, these are good pictures. I got to show these to Tina." And he took me in the dressing room, and Tina was liking my pictures. And pretty soon they had me coming on the road. I was traveling on the road with them. My first album cover about 10 months later was a picture of Tina Turner that I took in Los Angeles. And we started making videotapes for them. I had an early video, primitive kind of video machine. But it was the first time that Tina and the band could see themselves in action right after the show and go over the act and how they were dancing and kind of improve the act. So they liked that a lot.
Yeah. So you go from being like a young guy just hoping, you know, to get something going to standing in front of Tina Turner in a matter of seconds.
Yes. It was transformative. It was a moment that changed my life.
You spent a lot of time with them, didn't you?
Yes. Well, the next couple of years, not every day, but, you know, every few weeks we'd go and spend a couple of weeks. At one point, we spent a month traveling with them, actually living in Bollock Sound in their studio in Los Angeles. You didn't sleep a lot when you were with Ike Turner. You know? So we got a lot done.
Well, what were you doing when you were not sleeping?
Well, Ike had, you know, powders that helped you stay awake. And luckily, I didn't fall into it as deeply as he did. Because he was a pretty good guy until the drugs took over.
And he paid you, right? Sometimes people wouldn't pay you for the pictures. He was always generous about that, right?
Yeah, he always took care of them. It was kind of a very informal arrangement, depending upon how many days I had been there. You just sort of peel off a few $100 bills and cover all my expenses. That's how it worked out.
In all that time that you spent with him, did you see any hint of the abusive relationship that she would later describe?
Not really. They seemed pretty tight, you know, couple, not your traditional couple, because I had a girlfriend that traveled with them as well. So it was kind of like Ike and Tina and Ann Thomas. Not something they talked about at the time, but Tina's talked about it in her book that it was kind of like several women in the house, you know, not just her. And that did seem kind of unusual to me. I'm a bit more conservative than that. But in the rock and roll of it, it just seemed like, well, that's what Ike does, and everybody seems to go along with it. But I didn't see any of the violence at all. But it wasn't your typical marriage. That was obvious.
And out of that grew a lot of other contacts, and you managed to get a lot of other work, I assume.
Oh, yeah. Once I met them, I started meeting all kinds of people after that. Elton John was somebody I met within a few months, because a publicist that I met working with Ike and Tina talked a record company into hiring me to shoot this brand new unknown piano player from England, and it turned out to be Elton John. And then I worked for him for the next couple of years. And my career kind of snowballed. Every time I went and did a job, I'd meet more people and they'd hire me for more things, and I'd get involved in, you know, a lot of different jobs.
How did you get to know John Lennon?
Well, I met John and Yoko through an interview. It was a story about the Elephant's Memory Band that was backing them up. And after the interview, I asked if I could go to the studio and take pictures of them with the band. And then a couple of weeks later, it turned out that I was one of the only one who had pictures of them together, and they wanted to use the pictures in their album package. And that's the first time I went over to their house on Bank Street and actually sat in there for an afternoon and talked to them. And it turned out we shared a very cynical sense of humor and kind of got along really well. And at the end of that first meeting, actually, Yoko told me that they wanted to be in touch with me and they wanted me to come back and take more pictures. And I'm still in touch with Yoko today.
Yeah. I mean, I think you read the first time you actually sent them any pictures, you didn't even talk to anyone. They had said...
No, the first time I saw them actually was at the Apollo Theater a few months before I met them for the interview. They were there at a benefit concert for the families of the prisoners who were injured in the Attica prison riot. And I knew Aretha Franklin was going to be there, and I had gone to see her and take some pictures of her. And when I walked in, I heard the announcer say John Lennon and Yoko Ono, and I felt like I was hit by lightning. Like, I had read in the papers they were in New York. I was a huge fan of John and Yoko, even more than the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles were great, but I thought that John and Yoko were important, the work that they were doing for peace, and the way they were doing it with the artwork and getting in a bag and sending acorns to to the leader of every country in the world so the world could grow together. Just all kinds of media events to remind people to think about peace. And so when I walked in and I heard that John and Yoko were there, I couldn't believe I was in the same room as them. It was just such an exciting moment. And I took some pictures, and then backstage as they were leaving, they were waiting for their car, a few people were standing around taking pictures, snapshots with the Instamatic cameras. And so I took a few pictures with my cameras. And John at one point said, you know, people are always taking our picture like this, and we never see them. What happens to all these pictures? And I said, well, I live around the corner from you, because I'd read in the paper that they actually had a house literally half a block from my house in Greenwich Village. And I said, I live around the corner from you. I'll show you my pictures. And he, very neighborly, like, he said, oh, you live around the corner? Well, slip them under the door. And I went around a couple days later with some prints, and I didn't quite slip it under the door. I did ring the bell. And much to my surprise, Jerry Rubin answered the door.
Jerry Rubin.
I guess he was visiting them and just did him a favor to answer the doorbell.
The 60s radical, for those who may not remember him, yeah.
Yes, yeah, it was quite a surprise to see him, you know, opening the door for them. And I remember he asked me if they were expecting me, and I said no, and I just left them, you know, several pictures. And later, when we did develop a relationship, Yoko mentioned that everybody asked them for something. And I was one of the few people who actually gave them something and left without asking for anything, not even to meet them. And they were like, who is that guy? You know, and they liked the pictures, too. So when we did meet a few months later, they remembered that.
You know, you shot a lot of performance photos. And, you know, musicians tend to perform in places that don't have a lot of light, a lot of illumination. I mean, maybe this is a little technical, but how did you get around that?
It was a problem all my life. You know, it's amazing that the digital photography now can see in the dark. It's fascinating. Back then, I was always struggling to try to get pictures, you know, in focus, because you had to shoot at such a slow speed with the camera wide open. It was hard to get sharp pictures in such a low light setting. And that's why a lot of my pictures are soft focus. And I like to say that sometimes the subject's not sharp, but the feelings are clear.
You know, the other thing is, you did a lot of shooting in front of the stage, and crowds can get really torqued up and maybe drunk or high. I'm wondering, were some bands easier than others in terms of dealing with a raucous crowd?
Oh, absolutely. The Who in Philadelphia, I remember, as one of the you know, most chaotic, where you got like 250, 300-pound drunk guys falling on each other and banging into each other. On the other hand, the Bay City Rollers is a band I did a lot of work with, and their fans were 13 and 14-year-old girls. And they were more excited than the Who fans, but they were smaller and much less dangerous.
You're right about doing some cocaine with Ike Turner, and I think on a trip to Nashville doing meth, and they're, you know, I don't know what all, plenty of pot. And I'm just wondering, you did a lot of work. Did it affect your work to the drinking and drugs?
Well, it was kind of part of the work. I carried a little flask of cognac in my camera case. It was part of my equipment. That's the way it was in the 70s. You know, it's so hard to understand in the sober light of today what it was like back then, that you would go into a record company office and, you know, the guy would take out some coke, you'd share a couple of lines, see if his was better than yours, you kind of discuss that, light a joint, open a beer, and then do some business, you know, talk business.
Wow.
That was the way it was. There wasn't bottled water. I don't remember seeing bottles of water, but we had lots of cans of beer. If there was orange juice around, it was for the vodka, you know. You know, thinking back, that's the way it was. It wasn't, I couldn't do it today. I don't know how I, you know, operated on that level back then, because the world isn't drunk anymore. You know, the world's pretty sober nowadays.
You know, you were known for being patient and developing relationships with musicians, and had great relationships with a lot. One that you didn't have such a great relationship with, Bob Dylan, right? What happened there?
Well, I'm such an admirer, but it just never really worked out. I mean, one time I took a picture right in his face at the bottom line. I don't think he appreciated that very much. But then when he had the Rolling Thunder tour, he was banning photography. He had one photographer that he had hired to, and he was going to approve those pictures. And he didn't want any other pictures. But I took it as a challenge as a journalist to, I thought it was an important news event that had to be covered. And I literally put cameras in my boots and a lens in my hood, and I snuck my equipment into the concert. And during the encore, when everybody was standing on their seats and chaos was raining, I would jump up and take a whole bunch of pictures. And then a lot of them were published in magazines and newspapers. And I didn't realize that Bob Dylan was going to take that as a personal offense, since he had tried to ban photography. I guess it was about a year later, he was playing in Berlin, and his publicist told me about it, and I actually went to Berlin because I was on my way to Europe anyway, and I thought it'd be exciting to see him there. But when I got there, they had switched hotels, and I was in a cab on the way to a venue when I saw Bob walking across the street with a friend of mine. The bodyguard was a friend of mine. So I got into the cab. I just got so excited seeing Bob Dylan and my friend. And I got out of the cab and I walked down towards them, and Bob saw me coming. He turned around and I had no idea what to say to him. And so I said hello to my friend, Patty Kelly. And I said, "Hey, Patty, what are you doing?" And Bob got bored immediately and started walking away. And then Patty said, "Well, we'll see you at the show." And then he must have said something to Bob, or Bob asked who that was. And he turned around and he started looking at me. He said, "I know you. I saw your name next to all those pictures you took. And I always thought I was going to beat you up when I met you." And he had a cane with a silver head. And he's like waving this cane in front of me. And I'm kind of looking at my friend Patty going, "I know you're his bodyguard, but you're going to protect me because you're my friend, right?" And I started, you know, apologizing, you know, trying to defend it and saying I took really good pictures. And anyway, it was kind of like meeting God and finding out that he wanted to kill me. And in a sense, that made me stronger, because I no longer had a hero that I could really look up to for any kind of protection.
But you still love his music.
Still love his music. And it's always meant a lot to me, actually. In the early days, a lot of his songs were saying things I didn't really have words to, you know, things that I was thinking that I didn't have words to express. And he expressed my thoughts for me.
Do you have memories of shots that you just missed? A moment that you thought, ah.
Oh, a couple of times. Bob Dylan was one of them. When I went all the way to Atlanta and snuck into one of the Rolling Thunder shows. And towards the end, I was standing on a seat during the encore. And in fact, the governor at that point, Jimmy Carter, was governor there. And so Bob Dylan was kind of looking over in his direction. And I was about three rows behind him. So I was getting these pictures, great pictures of Bob Dylan looking right in my direction with a telephoto, getting like waist to head shots. It was like cover, poster, perfect pictures. And I was shooting and shooting and shooting. And after a little while, I realized I was taking an awful lot of pictures for one roll of film. And I went and checked and realized that, you know, when you run out of film in one camera, you have a black and white camera and a color camera, and you change the film, you would wait till both of them needed to be changed, and then you changed it. And in the rush and the heat of the moment, trying to get everything done, I had forgotten to change the film in the color camera. And I was taking more than a roll of film with no film in the camera. So, yeah, I remember what he looked like. He looked so good.
You're 75 today?
In October, I turned 75, yep.
You still working?
I'm working all the time. I'm working right now.
Okay, you got the book, right?
Yep.
Do you shoot? Do you get out and do commercials?
It's not the same because so many people are shooting and the outlets are so different that I don't work like I used to. I still sometimes work with certain bands that I, develop a relationship with. More recently, it was a band called The Stripes from Ireland that I did some work with. But it's not, I don't work like I used to. I don't jump on a bus for 10 days, with a bunch of 24-year-olds drinking beer. My life's a little different. Luckily, I can do exhibits and do, give talks to people and sell the signed prints in galleries.
Well, Bob Gruen, the book is fun. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Bob Gruen's new memoir is called Right Place, Right Time, The Life of a Rock and Roll Photographer.